I just want to get started. So, but before I begin, I don't want to trust myself, so I'm going to take a moment to pray. God, I don't have all the answers, and I don't understand everything, and so I believe that you're true, and if that's true, then you do know everything, and so help me tonight, and help me to be humble and teachable, but also be able to make the message clear and have fun and make it enjoyable and help it make it understandable and not try to prove that I'm smart, but just to try to just seek and look together. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Was Darwin perplexed? Like I like to do, I like to start out with definitions because I don't like arguing with people when they don't know what a term is, because that's just no fun, because then they don't know what you're talking about, and then you're not getting anywhere. Natural selection. Natural selection is the process whereby organisms better adapted to their environment tend to survive and produce more offspring. The theory of its action was first fully expounded by Charles Darwin and is now believed to be the main process that brings about evolution. Compare with survival of the fittest. So then I was like, well, I'll look up survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest is in biology the continued existence of organisms that are best adapted to their environment with the extinction of others. Just remember, that's very important. Keep that in the back of your mind as we go through this, with the extinction of others. As a concept in the Darwinian theory of evolution, compare with natural selection. Well, we already read that, so. For them, the Darwinists, natural selection is a tautology. I'll give you that definition in a minute. Which states a heretofore unrecognized relation. The fittest defined as those who will leave the most offspring will leave the most offspring. Of one thing, however, I am certain, and that is that natural selection affords no explanation of mimicry or of any other form of evolution. It means nothing more that the survivors survive. Why do certain individuals survive? Because are they the fittest. Why are they the fittest? Because they survive. So a tautology is the saying of the same thing twice in different words, generally considered to be a fault of style. A simpler example of this. Why did it survive? Because it is the fittest. How do you know it is the fittest? Because it survived. So, and I've actually read, and that's kind of what he does in his whole book. So he uses that quite a bit. But even many scientists that I've read that totally believe in evolution say that Darwin wasn't all that great at in his wording and his theory. So we can't hold it against him completely, I guess. So now we're going to look at Darwin's finches, which are some of the most famous ideas. You could call it an icon of proving evolution, his finches. So we'll look at some facts about the finches. Many biology textbooks give Darwin undeserved credit for the use of the finches as an example of natural selection in the theory of evolution. The facts are, the finches are not discussed in Darwin's diary except for one passing reference, and the finches are never mentioned in Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. The natural selection observed in the 1970s actually reversed direction soon after, resulting in no net evolutionary change. Several finch species appear to be merging through hybridization, and Darwin attributed the differences in bill size and feeding habits among these finches to evolution that occurred after their ancestors migrated the Galapagos Islands. Grant's experiments. Now I'm going to look at that whole thing in 1970. What happened, what he saw, what his conclusions were, and what happened afterwards. First, there was a drought, which reduced the seeds and the availability of them, and that resulted in a 15% reduction of the island's species of the medium ground finch. The survivors tended to have bigger beaks, and natural selection favored the birds because they were able to get through the tough seeds. And then the average beak was about increased to about 5%, which is not that much, but it did increase. So his conclusion from this observation was that natural selection can produce changes in beaks. This could also explain the origin of species among Darwin's finches. It would require 20 such selection events to transform one species into another. With one drought each 10 years, this would take only about 200 years. So he made this, you know, guess that if droughts keep happening, that there could be a new species in 200 years. But when you study the finches, chromosome studies show no difference among the finches. No natural selection in the wild has ever been observed, and finches are still finches today. Then he later went and saw this. Increase in finch population, and the average beak size returned back to its previous size after it started raining again. And then he also saw that oscillating, or that it kind of went like, the beak size kind of went like this. So it produced no net change in Darwin's finches. Several species of the finches started to be like mating with each other, merging into one. And then the finches seemed to be oscillating as far as like you had a bunch of finches and then they started breaking off and then they started coming back together. So there was no evolutionary change. They were just staying within finch ideas. So perhaps there's not that many different species after all. In fact, scientists acknowledge that all dogs descended from a common ancestor. Yet there are far greater differences among dogs than there are among the Darwin finches or than most other subspecies in the world. All biologists classify dogs as being in the same species. In fact, they're starting in some scientific studies to include the wolf also. So here we have St. Bernard, Chihuahua, same species. And then they're trying to tell me all these different finches and stuff are going to become different species when they're not even close to being as different as a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard. Okay. Charles Darwin gave many examples of variation within species, and then he tried to use them to prove evolution outside of the species. That's taking a leap of faith, something that you need to trust in or believe in, because I believe that there's variation within a species. I don't argue with that. Early creationists did argue with that, but that's, you know, that wasn't because they were being very logical or scientific. So, but you look at it, it makes sense with Noah's Ark. It makes sense for what we see. We don't have to argue with it. The Bible even says that there's different kinds of animals. It doesn't say species, and kinds can be bigger. It could be like the genus level or then the next level up. I don't know. Remember, taxonomy was just created by humans to organize it. It's not an exact science. New species. So the idea that Darwin used within the species change. But what about the idea of new species? Well, Darwin said in a letter, when we descend to details, we can prove that no species has changed, nor can we prove that the supposed changes are beneficial, which is the groundwork of the theory. Stephen Jay Gould said, most species exhibit no directional change during their tenure on Earth. They appear in the fossil record looking much the same as when they disappeared. Morphological change is usually limited and directionless. Sorry. All right. So basically, Stephen Jay Gould says, listen, we can't observe any change. That's why there's two different ideas of survival of the fittest and evolution. There's the idea of gradualism, which is more like what Darwin taught, and the idea of punctuated equilibrium. Gradualism is very slow change. Punctuated equilibrium is kind of like steps or leaps, and then no change, and then a step, and no change, and a step. Like quick, rapid mutations, and then no change for a long time, and quick, rapid mutations. Because he said, I can't see any changing in my lifetime. So obviously, we must be in that time where it's equilibrium, and that evolution isn't happening yet. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. Evolution, at least in the sense that Darwin speaks of it, cannot be detected within the lifetime of a single observer. So you can't see it. Remember what the definition of science was? It needs to be able to be seen. I admit, there's tons of stuff in the Bible and creationism that I need to take faith on. But I don't make claims that you need to see everything. I'm not making that claim. I'm saying you have to have faith. I don't make the claim that you can't have faith. In fact, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, it gives the definition of faith, and the first example of faith is believing in creation. So I can't say it's complete, 100% visible scientific evidence. I do think that, like forensics, you can find evidences that support it, but I don't claim that you don't need faith. The geological record, Darwin said, in Origin of Species, is extremely imperfect, and this fact will to a large extent explain why we do not find intermediate varieties. Connecting together all the extinct and existing forms of life by the finest graduated steps, he who rejects these views on the nature of the geological record will rightly reject my whole theory. Will do what? So he said, listen, if you're basing it on the record of the geology and missing fossils, you're rightly rejecting to my theory. You're doing a good job. I went on to read that in context. He tries to explain it away, saying that the world's so big, how could we ever, you know, he said, how could we ever right now have a full understanding of all the fossils? He says, and then he predicted that more of these fossils would start showing up later on in the book. So the question is, has that happened? Well, in 1981, it said there, now we have 100 million fossils all cataloged and identified in the museums around the world. So has the geological record according to the fossils been improved? If we have 100 million. Yeah, it's improved. Has it proved Darwin's theory? Again, I quote Darwin, intermediate links, geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic change. And this is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory. I like how Darwin in his theory is trying to argue with it and answer. I like that. He's not trying to hold it up as a dogma. I do appreciate that when I read his book, that he had lots of arguments against his own theory, which he could not prove. I do like that. I found that more honest after reading it. I have more respect for Darwin than I once did before after reading his book. And then came the Cambrian explosion, which they kind of knew about in his time, but now we really, really know about it with new research. The Cambrian explosion is this low-level rock. They find all these fossils in it, all of a sudden just appearing. This David Berlinski is quoted as that there is no question that such gaps exist. A big gap appears at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion over 500 million years ago when great numbers of new species suddenly appeared in the fossil record. In fact, some more facts about the Cambrian explosion is that the fossil record shows that phylum level differences appear at the lowest levels, i.e. in the Cambrian period. This has been referred to as the Cambrian explosion. There is no fossil evidence connecting Cambrian animals to organisms preceding them, and there is no long history of gradual divergence predicted by Darwin. The Cambrian explosion gave rise to most of the animal phyla alive today, as well as some phyla that are now extinct. In fact, I was watching this video called Icons of Evolution, where this guy, who does not believe in the literal creation account, he does believe that some kind of intelligent design did work, but I mean, this guy's a biologist at Berkeley, so he's not, I don't know his background as far as a Christian and everything, but he writes this book and they interview him, and they start talking about him, and then they went and interviewed this guy in China who's doing work in a Cambrian explosion, you know, fossil record site, and he's doing all this recording and fossils, and he's categorizing and cataloging all these fossils. And they're just saying, they're talking to him and interviewing him. He says, Darwin in his book made this tree, and it started out kind of like a trunk here, and it branched off and branched off and branched off. And he says, from what I'm finding, there is more species back then than there are today. We should flip that whole tree upside down. It's actually coming up like this, the way he understands it. Now, mind you, he still believes in like an evolutionary tree. He just says it's wrong. But in the textbooks today, it's still drawn with one branch breaking off. But the fossil record says opposite. So the facts, what they show, are showing the opposite. So they're putting the opposite. So yes, I maybe have been wrong in my mammoth date, but they're wrong in the textbooks about the tree. The scientists are saying Cambrian explosion, this is this outdated tree, and they're still in the textbooks. We need to update them. But they're not. And so it should be drawn up like that. And so then they're arguing, well, listen, we don't want to throw it all away. Maybe in the layer underneath, because the intermediate links are made out of soft tissue, they couldn't survive, so it would be bad fossil record. So it's like, well, I'll dig deeper. So he goes to the layer underneath, and he starts digging, which would be the next geological age. You know what they found? Fossils of sponges and jellyfish and soft animals. So you can't use that argument that the animals are soft. Which is when I looked up in the objection to Cambrian explosion, what they said, well, he's finding that the layer underneath, they're finding tons of fossils of soft-bodied animals, and they're nowhere near intermediate links. So there's a big, big problem for the idea of Darwin's evolutionary tree. Colin Patterson, writing about some objections. I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would have certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Remember this quote in Friday night's presentation when I talk about human evolution. He says, listen, I cannot find one watertight argument for a transitional fossil. He cannot find one. Given the fact, Ernest Mayr, professor of emeritus at the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University, says, given the fact of evolution, one would expect the fossils to document a gradual steady change from ancestral forms to the descendants. But this is not what the paleontologists find. Instead, he or she finds gap in just about every phylic series. They're just saying there's huge gaps, which means that you would need faith or belief to believe that these gaps were crossed, because there's just huge gaps. Even Charles Darwin thought natural selection could not account for peacock's tails or similar fantastic structures so prominent in courtship displays. On the contrary, elaborate appendages or tail feathers could easily get in the way when animals had to escape enemies. Still, if elaborate plumage makes the bird more vulnerable to predators, why should evolution favor them? So now I'm kind of switching subjects. I'm going to go into this idea of the world around us and what we see and trying to figure out how in the world, if evolution's true, could it occur? And so Darwin was puzzled by the peacock. He was perplexed. He says, I don't get it. It should have been extinct. It should have been wiped out. It's ridiculous. Predators should have just killed this out of the way a long time ago, because it would hinder them. And so the first example I want to look at is the giraffe. Now, I read in the book about the giraffe. I didn't have time to write it aloud and quote it. The giraffe, he kind of was talking about, originally there's this guy, and he came up with this theory called Lamarckism, where he basically said that the giraffe would stretch his neck, and it would get longer, and as straining went on, it would get longer and longer and longer, and over time, it would end up being the giraffe. Well, they said that they disproved that. They said that's ridiculous. It's not true. But what Darwin would say is just a little bit different. Really, when I was reading it, I was like, I don't see a lot of difference. What he said is just that there'd be a common ancestor between maybe the giraffe, the gazelle, or whatever in Africa, you know, the four-legged hoofed animals. They'd be all have the same length of neck. And eventually, the ones with the longer necks that were born would survive out all the other ones, and all the other ones would die off. And so he's saying it would get longer and longer and longer. But there's a problem with the giraffe neck. It's not that simple. It's not just having a long neck. There's other stuff that has to be there to help it have the long neck. Giraffes are about 18 feet tall. And because they get up to about 18 feet tall, there was one, the tallest that's ever been recorded, I think, was 20 feet. They have to have a giant heart. And this heart can be up to 22 inches long. So this massive heart has to pump the blood all the way up to the brain, up that long, long neck. So not only do you have to have the neck evolve, you also have to have what evolve with it? His heart. Because if it was a little heart and a long neck, what would happen? It wouldn't get blood to the brain. The baby would wake up, stand up, get dizzy, fall over, and it would become lion food. And then natural selection would have selected it out of the process. So two things have to evolve at once. Okay. The problem with the idea of the big heart and the big neck is that when it bends over to get a drink of water, it's really thirsty. It bends over. And that heart just squeezes a ton of blood, and then all of a sudden it doesn't have to go uphill, it goes downhill. And it flows super fast, and bam, instant aneurysm. The giraffe falls over in the water, and it becomes crocodile food. Natural selection selects it out of the process, it never evolves. So that's a problem. You can't just have a big heart and a long neck. You also have to have special design that would allow the brain not to burst. What happened is as the giraffe bends over, there's actually little shut-off valves in the blood that shut off the blood so that when it bends over, it doesn't pop its brain. So we know that it needs it, because why would it have shut-off valves? So not only do you have to have a big heart and a long neck, you have to have shut-off valves at the same time. And then it does something else. It doesn't have a shut-off valve at the end. It has a sponge. And you're probably asking, why does it have a sponge? Well, because when it stands back up after it takes a drink, if it was the blood was shut off. I have a friend who's like really tall. He was at college with me. We're laying down studying or something, and he jumped up, and then he went, whoa, and then he fell back over again. Because he didn't get enough. He jumped up and the blood didn't get to his brain and he got real wheezy and almost fell over. So if the giraffe is drinking and it stands up and it just has a shutoff valve, it would get really dizzy, fall over, and either become alligator food, lion food, or whatever kind of food. Natural selection, boom, it's gone. No more giraffe. Can't reproduce, can't evolve. But it has a sponge. And what the sponge does is when it stands back up, it squeezes the blood back to the brain and allows time for the blood to pump it back up to the brain. So if the sponge wasn't there, the valves weren't there, the long neck was there, and the big heart wasn't there, it would become naturally selected out of the way. All the components have to be there at once. And so this brings up the idea of a fancy theory called irreducibly complex. And the biggest guy, the proponent of this, is Behe. Now, mind you, I'm going to hardly use any examples he had in his book because they're so overused that I thought, well, people just make up stuff and philosophize them away. Like he has this mouse trap and he makes this mouse trap. I want to decide, well, how do they argue that away? Well, check this out. This is what they do. They say, well, we can imagine this. Imagine. Okay? So it took a creative mind. Okay? They would take the mechanisms on the mouse trap and stick it on the floor and they go, look, we got rid of one piece. No, you didn't. This is still much as a board as the floor. So then they imagined that it was stuck to something else. Well, that's just equally a board as anything else. You didn't do anything. You just substituted something that's a little more... The wall and the floor is more complicated than a board. So you actually substitute much more complicated. Then they went down and had some wires scrambled together. Like, that would just snap. That's not going to catch no mouths. So it wouldn't naturally select and wouldn't make it. I read the arguments. It was very creative. Very creative. But it wasn't science. It wouldn't work. And it's really just, it proves that a creator can make steps in between with imagination. It doesn't prove natural selection. And the thing is, the way that they teach, even if it's punctuated equilibrium, you would have to have five mutations at once to make it work. On top of that, remember the definition was that the other forms have to be extinct? The gazelle, the wildebeest, the impala, all these short-necked creatures live right alongside the giraffe, and they haven't been extinct. And they have short necks. So the extinction didn't happen around them. Moving on, the woodpecker. The woodpecker is very complicated. It's not like most other birds around it. It has a harder beak, and it has special feet. The feet in normal birds have two in the front, one in the back. The woodpecker has two on each side so that it can grab the tree and stay there. But that's not all. It doesn't just have a hard beak. It doesn't just have feet that are special. It has these tail feathers that are stronger so it can tripod itself and anchor itself on the tree. So let's say you had a hard beak that evolved at the same time that you had feet evolve and the same time you had the tail feathers evolve and allow itself to perch up on the tree. You still have a problem. As you're bashing your head all day, you get brain damage. I played football. We went to the state championship in football tournament in Michigan. The leading fullback was this big old colossal guy who should have been a lineman, but he was fast as a fullback. The reason why we won the state championship, we were from Grand Rapids and we played a Detroit team. Detroit teams are much faster, pass the ball. They were beating us like 21-0, but we just methodically pounded the ball up the middle. Well, this guy, he wouldn't move. He wasn't juking anybody. He'd just run people over. In fact, they put everybody in the football game up against him, and everybody would try tackling him, and it took three or four guys to bring him down. I talked to the guy, and he can't talk in coherent sentences because he has so much brain damage from that year of football. Because you just smash into people. So even if you had all this evolved, you have a problem. The bird would get brain damage and wouldn't last very long. So it would be selected out of the way. On top of that, it had a special tongue. So, in between its beak and its skull, it has developed a shock absorber. So not only do you have to have the three things I mentioned, you need a shock absorber to evolve at the exact same time so it wouldn't get brain damage and die and be selected out of the way. And then, it's not just a shock absorber, it has the thickest skull per body weight of any other animal. In fact, scientists are studying this, trying to figure out how to protect people from brain damage. They're studying something that was an accident so that they can have better science, so that we can create something better. Interesting. And then on top of that, the woodpecker would pop its eyeballs out unless it would have special eyelids to close to keep them in, and then it wouldn't know where it's hitting, so it opens its eyes every time and then closes, opens, close. Have you ever heard the woodpecker? Does it, like, take time? What's it sound like? Yeah. Every time, in between each peck, it's opening its eyes. That's pretty special, and that's a pretty tricky. So it's a pretty complicated bird, right? Okay. Now the tongue. The tongue is 6 inches long. Most birds only go to the end of the beak. Its tongue goes past the beak. And not only that, it's barbed, has special barbs. So that it can grab the bug. And then on top of that, to keep the bug on there, it developed a glue. So not only do you need a special long tongue, a barbed tongue, you need to have it to develop glue, which is not normal for birds. And then if it had this glue and everything else evolved, and then it went to swallow the bug, it'd swallow its tongue, choke to death and die and be selected out of the way, but it evolved the solvent. You understand the glue and the solvent have to evolve at the same time. We have never seen one mutation occur that's beneficial, let alone, how many do you need? And you don't have any intermediate species in between. No visible proof here, no visible proof there. I just don't have enough faith in the theory of evolution to imagine anything else, because that's what I would have to do. I would have to use my imagination, my creative ability, to make intermediate links, because there's nothing in the fossil record. There's nothing in mutations showing that mutations happen that quickly that you could go from whatever bird, finch to woodpecker, because everything would have to be there. I don't have enough faith. I can't trust human science that much to believe that evolution had happened. But that's not all. Now this one, I don't understand at all. How did that evolve? The tongue goes down the throat, not out the mouth. It goes down the throat, up through, around the brain, through the nose, back out the beak. I don't get that. I've never seen one of our babies born with the tongue hanging out of its nose, let alone going down the throat, around the back, up over the brain, out the nose. In order for that to happen, he would have to be born with a tongue like that. I don't have enough faith in the theory for that to happen. I don't trust it. I admit, I don't have the faith to do it. I just don't. I just can't. I don't understand that. That doesn't make any sense. Now, I could use my imagination and say, well, one time there's a woodpecker that didn't have a tongue, and then later on had one that goes up into the brain, and then the next offspring had one that goes up over there. But punctuated, that's gradualism. Punctuated equilibrium says that would pop out of another normal woodpecker just like that. I've never seen that happen in science. Never has it been recorded in history. I just don't have enough faith in the theory to believe in that. And that brings me to the next interesting animal. This is called the Chuckwalla lizard. The Chuckwalla lizard is very interesting. It lives in the desert, so it doesn't get a lot of water. So it has a special thing where it only eats food and extracts the water out of its food, and thus that's how it gets its water. But the problem is it builds up a bunch of salt. And so normally the blood pumps through the Chuckwalla lizard, and then when it builds up in salt, it decides to send it up to the nose where it has a desalting process thing, which takes the salt out of the blood, so it cleans the blood, and then it sneezes pure salt. They get rid of the salt. Now, for all that all to happen, just in this part of the lizard, you'd have to be able to redirect the blood to the nose. And then at the same time, because you just don't want a bloody nose all the time, you'd have to have this process there to take the salt out of the blood. And then you have to have the idea to take that and make it sneeze out. And the whole time, you first need to have it evolve where it doesn't need any. It doesn't need to drink water. It can get it from its food. But if it just evolved the first thing, the salt build up and it would die. So all the parts need to be there at the same time. And the only way I can explain it is if I use my imagination to make up a bunch of ideas in between. And I just don't trust my imagination enough to believe in the theory of evolution. Other facts. Not only does it have that, when it's chased and it runs away and wants to hide, it hides into a crack and it blows itself up so you can't pull it out of its crack and be eaten. So even if it had the desalting process and it didn't have that, it would die because all the predators would be able to pull it out of the rocks. So it would have been selected out of the way. So both of these things help it to survive. And then it also can change colors to help it deal with body temperature. That's super complicated. I just don't have enough faith in the theory to believe that. The chicken egg. Now, most of these animals I got, so you can see there's tons more. I just picked out some of my favorite. They're from these three videos called Incredible Creatures That Defy Evolution by Job Martin. He was an evolutionist, and this is what happened. He was teaching zoology, and these kids would come up, "Hey, tell me how this evolved. Hey, tell me how this evolved." And he got so sick of it because he couldn't explain it. So he started researching evolution, find out a lot of this stuff that he used to believe in was based on presumption, or basically leaps of faith. He started realizing, man, I just don't trust this anymore. And then he became a creationist, and he teaches about the things that were used against him that he couldn't explain. And so he presents these things, and he's waiting for explanations. So here's the chicken egg. Now, the chicken egg, I didn't even know. Like, I just took it for granted. Chicken egg, simple, right? It's interesting. You can't see it very well, but there's little bubbles when you boil the egg. That's because the egg is porous so that air can go in there so that the chicken breathes. That's pretty interesting. In fact, the way they're porous is they go from a small, I think they go, I can't remember, small to wide or wide to small. That helps as it chips away. It helps it get more air. But moving on, so the eggshell is porous for air exchange. Now, exactly the fifth day, not the fourth day, not the sixth day, it has this development where the blood vessel hooks up to an air sac and the blood vessel hooks up the oak so it can eat and so it can breathe. Exactly the fifth day. If it does it any later, it dies. No more natural selection, chicken's dead. So exactly the fifth day, it does this. And then exactly the 19th day, the chick has this little egg tooth. It's this tooth, which if you look and study chickens and you didn't know what happened to an egg, you'd probably say it's a vestigial organ and think it was coming from a dinosaur and that's where the tooth ended up, but that's not what happened. It's actually used only when breaking out of the egg. So it starts breaking up, and when you cut open a hard-boiled egg, you'll notice at one point there's this flat spot and an empty spot. That's the air sac. Well, as it's popping open and getting to that spot, it gets to the air sac, and it gives it 6 hours. Exactly enough time for the chick to break out by day 21. If any day, if any specific time changes, we don't have chickens anymore. They've been selected out of the process. So just in egg development, we see super complex mechanisms. Everything has to happen at a specific time. So you have to ask the question, where did the whale come from? I'll quote from Darwin. I read it out of that book. I'm going to read it out of the book. Because when I read this on the internet, I didn't believe it. Let me try finding it. The problem is they don't unify page numbers, so. And I shouldn't have took the page markers out of there. Well, trust me, it's in there. You can look it up yourself. I read it on my own eyes. I don't want to waste that time. Okay, this is what Darwin said. He said he was reading a report about zoology in North America, and it says, "In North America, the black bear was seen by herons swimming for hours with widely open mouth, thus catching, like a whale, insects in the water. Even so extreme a case like this, if the supply of insects were constant and if better adapted competitors did not already exist in the country, I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till a creature was produced as monstrous as the whale." That takes faith. That is ridiculous. And the literal term of ridiculous means subject to ridicule. Like, even scientists mock Darwin for that. But this is the basis for, you know, this is one of the biggest bases for the belief of evolution. And this is the ridiculousness that's in that book. Like, this is the most extreme case, but there's other ridiculous ideas that are put in that book. Like, ridiculous. Like, even evolutionists think some of the stuff that Darwin said was ridiculous. But that brings up another point. The bear. Is the bear simple? Just the idea of hibernation. I'll take the mother bear. The mother bear goes in hibernation. While in hibernation, it's nursing its cub for 5 to 7 months. During the whole time, it's not drinking any water or eating, and it's nursing. How, moms, how would you like that? Would you like to nurse your baby and not drink any water? Is that complicated? Is that pretty hard to do? That's what it does. And then, to make up for this, so what came first, the hibernating or the complex factory that causes the fat to be broken down and turned into water so it can sustain itself during hibernation? Both these things had to happen at once, because his complicated factory, he would never use it. So you pass it on and it basically disappear because you never use it unless you start hibernating. But hibernation's difficult, not just in the fact that it doesn't eat or drink the whole time, but it doesn't exert any waste. All of a sudden it switches, it's exerting waste, and then, oh, I'm hibernating, I'm going to turn into recycle mode. Like, just all of a sudden it turns into recycle mode. Like, that all would have to be there at the same time. And then it doesn't lose its body fat. Like humans, if we slept that long, we would lose all our body fat and we'd be like bedridden and we'd have to go through physical therapy just to be able to walk again. They couldn't figure it out. How can a bear sleep all this time, come out of the cave and ready to hunt? It comes out ready to hunt and rip things up and get ready to kill things to feed its young. What they've been finding, they've been testing hibernating bears and putting all sorts of tests on it. They find that it gets into these fits. And they've been testing it, and it's actually like isometric exercises all winter long while it's hibernating so it can keep strong so when it comes out. And then I was watching this BBC special, and it talked about the polar bear, and it came out, and they said if it couldn't find food immediately for its cubs, the cub and her would die. And it wouldn't eat for itself. It only would hunt for its cubs. So if it comes out like a wimp, and every nearest mountain lion's like, cub and mama bear for dinner because it can't fight me. Now, if it can come out strong, what's the mountain lion going to do? It ain't going to do nothing unless that cub has wandered away from mama for a long time. So if all this stuff couldn't happen, bears selected out of the way, and we don't have to worry about it becoming whales because it wouldn't make it. But let's look at whales. I'm going to look at the sperm whale and some other whale facts, but especially the sperm whale. Now, whales, the biggest whales, they can breathe 5,000 gallons of air a minute. That's complicated. That's a big breath. It can weigh up to 300,000 pounds. Its tongue can weigh as much as an elephant. Dinosaurs are small when it comes to whales. Not even close. They're the biggest animals that ever existed, ever, that we've seen in the fossil records. And listen, they have flippers. Their flippers have all the blood vessels on them, and they're used as air conditioners or as heaters. They either stick them out in the sun like solar panels, or they put them in the cool so it can regulate its body temperature so that it can survive. More than that, they use air bubbles, and they like use it to surround up the krill so it can come up underneath and gobble it up. This is extremely complicated. This is how it gets its food. Now, the sperm whale can dive at 550 feet a minute. And when it gets down to the bottom to conserve energy, it just all of a sudden shuts down everything except for the heart, the brain, and the tail and goes hunting. So it has enough energy to make it all the way back up. If it did not evolve this, whale goes down, selected out of existence. So it needs that feature too. But not only that, as it's diving down, there's one atmosphere every 12 feet. So atmospheric pressure changes 12 feet every 12 feet. A 70-foot long makes it about 3 or 5 different amounts of pressure on its body as it's diving down. But it can direct the pressure of its body. It has this giant heart and special blood vessels. So it has a big heart and these special blood vessels so that it can redirect the pressure and survive. Otherwise, the whale would be all like messed up and get the bends really bad. Probably not the bends. That's probably not the word for it. But it definitely would be all squished and messed up. But it's especially have all this stuff together so it can do what it needs to do. I just don't have enough faith that evolved from a bear. It can communicate hundreds of miles, and it's highly social. In fact, we developed, created, made sonar by studying them. So how am I supposed to trust, believe, have faith that that was created by an accident? If we couldn't even figure it out except for by studying them, very hard for me to believe or have faith in. And then the blowhole is not connected to the mouth, so how'd that evolve? Like, just kind of travel up to the top of its head, and then all of a sudden disconnected over slow time? Or did it mutate all at once, but then it has to have everything else and be able to breathe all that air at one time? It's just too complicated for me to believe and trust. Okay, they don't believe it's from bears anymore. So I'm sorry for saying that, but this is what they believe. Transitional forms have once been scarce. Notice that they've once been scarce. A few Chesta fossils were recently discovered in India of a four-legged mammal whose skull and teeth resemble whales. Saw a picture of this. It has like the bottom jaw, not even the whole jaw, a piece of the skull, a piece of the front limb, and a piece of the back leg. And then they imagined all the rest. And they said, oh yeah, this is the intermediate link. No. That's, you could give that to any artist and have them make up what you think that is. I don't know if it's in between. It's like imagination. Like, it's really, they imagined the ribs, they imagined a bunch of stuff. So you have to use a lot of imagination. So I like that they few fossils, and it's very true. During the 1980s, serum protein tests were made on whale's blood to compare it with the biochemistry of other living animal groups. The results linked them not to bears or carnivores, but to hoofed animals. Forerunners of the whales were closely related to the ancestors of cattle, deer, and sheep. I believe the bear better than I believe a cow or an antelope or water buffalo. I'm sorry, I don't have enough faith to think that it came from a cow or cattle or whatever. That it wouldn't exactly be a cattle. It would be some cattle, deer-like animal. I just don't have enough faith that that's what happened. Okay. Such a conclusion fits with the general behavior of great baleen whales, who move in pods or herds and strain the sea for plankton. They are like antelopes or cattle or social grazers. But these aren't the only kind of whales there are. There's a killer whale with teeth. And have you ever seen how these things work? Cow cheweth the cud, swallows, regurgitates it, chews it again, versus an animal of straining. Those are very two different feeding patterns. I need to see some links between those two that are not imagination. That's very different. Very. Like, I need to see some fossils. Everything else is just your imagination. The elephant. The elephant's also very complicated. It has these giant ears to flap. I mean, the whale had the flipper, the elephant had the ear. So does this prove that they evolved from each other? Well, it's just interesting. I put my keys in the office, and Steve came in, and he grabbed the keys, and he looked at them, and he's like, these aren't my keys. These look like Jeep keys. I'm like, no, they're for my Chrysler. Why does the Chrysler and the Jeep keys look the same? Same maker. So if it works for one animal, why not do it in the other? Okay. Elephant calves weigh 200 pounds at birth and can weigh up to 11,000 pounds as adults. Okay. So they're super heavy. So because of that, they make this amazing foot. And if you look at the skeletal structure, it comes down, and it doesn't have a foot. It actually comes down on its tippy toes. Kind of humorous that the elephant always walks on its tippy toes. This is just actually a big ball of, like, fatty tissue. And because it's so heavy, it needs, you know, the bigger you are, the harder it is on your knees. I know, because I wasn't always skinny, as skinny as I am today, and my knees are paying for it from all those years of football. And so I wish I was even more skinnier. My knees still kind of hurt. But it needs that padding so it can protect all its joints, because if you were that big, you would want that too. And so it has that. It's so designed that it can actually walk silently, and it's this giant animal. Because it has all this fat in the feet. And then on top of that, it likes to go bathing because sometimes the ears aren't good enough, so it needs to go wash itself off and cool off. So it sinks way down in the mud, and the foot's so designed that when it pulls back up, it doesn't get stuck. It shrinks in size so it can pull up easily. Because, you know, if an elephant got stuck in mud, maybe that's why we have all the mastodons in the tar pits. Oh, wait, then they wouldn't have made it to the elephant today because they would have been selected out of the way. Okay. The trunk. The trunk is used for eating, bathing, and work, and has incredible smelling ability. The trunk contains over 100,000 muscle units, lifts, which are in six muscle groups. It lifts 500-pound logs, but it's sensitive enough to take something out of a child's hand. Quite complicated. Very far cry from a pig's nose or anything else I could imagine that it came from. 300-pound trunk tusks and 300-pound trunk and tusks at 200 pounds each. So you have a lot of weight. Then it has a porous skull, so it's not thick in the skull, so it can manage all that weight up front because it has a really light head, so it doesn't just fall over. So that's pretty nice. I mean, I'm glad that since I believe God exists, that he was nice enough to the elephant to make sure that it all fit out together. So, and I do agree that it would take faith, but again, I have to insist that the cow becoming a whale would take a lot of faith too. The gecko. The gecko is an amazing creature. Anyone have a pet gecko? Isn't it kind of cool how they can just run up and along the glass and stuff? It took scientists forever to figure out, how in the world is this gecko doing this? So they started, they started taking a microscope and looking at it, and they found that it has these little hairs on its feet. Then they were like, well, what do hairs do? They took it even closer, and they found that each of these little hairs has little suction cups on the end of the feet. And so there's some more feet. Now go back to this. Okay. So the suctions are incredibly powerful. So let's say you have the tiny hairs and the suction cups involved. It runs up here, and it sticks itself on here, and then all of a sudden, it's stuck. It can't pull the foot off. And it's stuck on there, and then whatever animals like to eat geckos, maybe some eagle flies by, snaps it off and pulls, and all you have is four little legs stuck on the wall. Man, I watched way too many horror movies when I was a kid. I was just imagining the blood flying all over out of the legs. Sorry. All right. To avoid permanent attachment, the gecko curls its toes as it walks. And that's why you have like the little, they're not straight. They have the rounded little pads. These are all specially designed so that actually they have other suction cups that are used to pull the other suction cups off so it doesn't in a circle. So it's all together there so that it can just pop off. That's pretty amazing. Another really cool one, I don't have time, and I couldn't go into the detail, but the dragonfly is just absolutely awesome. The reason why it's called the dragonfly is because it has this enormous mouth. You can just swallow things. In fact, the dragonfly larva is like the terror of the sea. It like just goes and devours tadpoles and little fish. Sometimes it just doesn't decide to fly for like 2 years because it can just like eat and eat and eat and eat and just devour things in the sea. And not the sea, the lake or the river or the pond or wherever it is. But then it decides to fly. And so when it becomes a dragonfly, it has these like the most complicated eye of any insect. I mean, there's 30,000 eye facets in that eye. That's a long way from a euglena eye spot, and it'd take a lot of faith to believe that little eye spot in the euglena, I think it was the euglena that I studied in biology, would eventually evolve into that. Very, very much faith to believe that. From one eye spot to 30,000 eye facets, I just can't imagine that. And then it has special wings. In fact, the wings are so special that we actually studied it, and that's how we got our helicopter. So a mistake, we study, we make a helicopter. Logical conclusions like that should be made too. They're super complicated. They're able to fly forward and backwards. It bends its body, and that's how it steers, and then the wings switch muscle groups and motion different ways. Out of the 800,000 insects, the dragonfly is the most acrobatic of the flyers. It has a speedometer located in its antenna, and it can swoop at 20 miles per hour. That's pretty fast for the little thing, swooping around and devouring everything in its path. They call it the T-Rex of the insects. The frail wings are paper thin. They have all these channels, and then the cells at the tips of the wings are thicker so it doesn't flatter and rip. They're perfectly designed. There's no way that could have accidentally happened. Just the idea of flight. You have the bat, you have the insect, you have the bird. The wings are completely different. Completely different. But they all fly. I just think it's just kind of cool about how this happened. And they all came from different common ancestors. And somehow they made it. I just don't have enough faith. And that's how we developed the helicopter. And so speaking of flight, this is still used in the textbooks, in many textbooks today, the peppered moths. They should take it out. It was proven kind of wrong. But basically, this is what they say. Most peppered moths were light-colored in the early part of the 19th century. Moths became predominantly black and near the heavily polluted cities in the Industrial Revolution. That's what they teach. Okay, this is the experiment. This guy performed some experiments. He suggested that predatory birds ate the light-colored moths when the they sat in the dark trees, and the dark-colored ones survived because the polluted trees, they could hide better. It appeared that natural selection played a role in the survival of the dark-colored variety of moths. Most biology textbooks illustrate examples of natural selection with photographs showing two varieties of peppered moths resting on light and dark-colored tree trunks. What they don't tell you is that the photographs are staged, since moths don't rest on tree trunks in the wild, that they stage this whole pictures. This right here, one of the reasons why I became and stayed an evolutionist, and it was a staged photo. The percentage of the black moths predicted by the theory did not actually happen or materialize in different areas of England. In fact, some areas the black moths increased after pollution controls were instituted. So the pollution went down, black moth population went up. So the original theory kind of didn't happen. The results of his experiment were not dependent on the presence of liches as he had thought, and later it determined that tree trunks are not actually the resting places of the moths. They actually rest underneath and then the sides of narrow branches. The moths were manually placed in the desired positions, basically their stage, so this casts doubt on the validity of the experiment. The evidence Darwin lacked, Kettlewell lacked as well. And then another quote, "The story of industrial melanism must be shelved as a paradigm of new Darwinian evolution." So why is it still in the textbooks? Maybe because they can't find a better idea. I don't know, but it should be taken out. So again, now I'll give you the official definition of gradualism. The hypothesis, that's supposed to be the hypothesis that evolution proceeds chiefly by the accumulation of gradual changes. Most scientists are throwing this out, even evolutionists. They're saying we just can't find it in the fossil records. It's just not true. So what they do is they have this theory. It's not working out, so they slap a hypothesis or another theory on top of it. Punctuated equilibrium. The hypothesis that evolutionary development is marked by isolated episodes of rapid speciation between long periods of little or no change. All right, here's the picture to help you get it. Gradualism, bunch of intermediate links. And they say we don't see this anywhere, so this is what we believe. An animal, and all of a sudden, boom, completely different. Boom, 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 but we've never seen this happen either. But according to the fossil record, that's what had to happen. But I just don't have enough faith that this could happen either because I don't see any possible mutations. So there's the idea of mutant flies. There's these mutant fruit flies. In fact, they did this test. Well, that one didn't do so well. That one's not any different. It's still a fruit fly. I don't care what color body it has. I mean, if this is producing another species, then racism is true. And same with that one. And I don't believe in racism, so, you know, it's same species. Curly wings would definitely not help it. Wingless, it's not a fly anymore, it's a crawl. And then stubby wings wouldn't help. So actually, the wild type is the better one. But then they finally did it. They came up with a four-winged fruit fly. Okay. But before we go to there, this is an excellent book, by the way. Small-scale evolution within a species, such as we see in the domestic breeding, makes use of variations already present in a population. But large-scale evolution, such as Darwin envisioned, is impossible unless new variations arise from time to time, or punctuated equilibrium. Genes consisting of DNA are the carriers of hereditary information. New variations originate as mutations. Most mutations are harmful. Mutations can have biochemical effects that render bacteria resistant to antibiotics, or insects are resistant to insecticides, for example. Biochemical mutations cannot explain the largest scale changes in the organisms. So they say, well, listen, we made bacteria that's resistant to biochemical effects such as antibiotics. Well, then they did this experiment. This one's really cool. You have to watch the video. I took this from the video of Icons of Evolution, and so I'm going to show it to you. They did this test. So they had these... Did I skip? Yeah, I did. Okay, so they did this test of bacteria. And so the green ones represent the ones resistant to the antibiotics, and these ones are all going to start dying. So then it creates a strain in the laboratory of this bacteria that's resistant to antibodies, and they form and they multiply. And so then they study out this idea of fitness cost. So they have this strain of ones resistant to antibodies, and they put it in the petri dish full of the original ones back into the wild. And so, over time, they disappear. The reason why they disappear is because, have you ever seen the movie Rain Man? The guy was really smart, right? Was he fully normal? So he had an mutation or an adaptation that made him better than humans in one aspect. But is he fully functional as a human? Was it fully beneficial? Well, what they found with the antibacterial resistant bacteria is that it can't reproduce quick enough and ends up getting beaten out by the regular ones. So it kind of disappears in the population. So when you reduce it back into the wild, the oscillation effects happens, and it, even though you selected them out, when you put them back into nature, they come back to normal again. So it never devolves into a new species. Okay. Unless a mutation affects morphology, the shape of an organism, it cannot provide raw materials for morphological evolution. Morphological mutations have been extensively studied in the fruit fly. And so basically they came up with this two-winged fruit fly that developed the second pair of wings. Mind you, four-winged fruit flies do not occur spontaneously. They must be bred in the laboratory from three artificially maintained mutant strains. So they have to maintain it. They have to do it. It doesn't happen in the wild. The extra wings lack flight muscles. They testify in the skill of the geneticist, and they help us understand the role of genes in development. So here's the flight pattern of a normal fruit fly. Taking off, just having a good old time. Doing really well. And then what they did is they started breeding them, and then they came up with another fruit fly that had a second pair of wings. And so what they do is they watch the video of the second fruit fly. This guy, they don't have flight muscles. That mutation wasn't so good. Basically, he was selected out of creation. He didn't even have the ability to take off. So, basically, these fruit fly studies, they provide no evidence that DNA mutations supply the raw materials for morphological evolution. No useful organisms has been produced, and the organisms that they do produce can't reproduce. The four-winged fruit fly does not provide the missing evidence for evolution. Genetic mutations are not the raw materials for large-scale evolutions because a fruit fly is still a fruit fly. Major mutations such as Biobithrorax are such evident freaks that these monsters can be designated only as hopeless. They are so utterly unbalanced that they would not have the slightest chance of escaping elimination through natural selection. Harvard biologist Ernest Mayer. Geneticists have found that the number of wings in flies can be changed through mutations of a single gene. So they're only messing with one gene and it's just not working out for them. So then one other idea is homology, and this is kind of like the last little beacon or bulwark of evolution that I'm going through tonight. So these are the bones showing homology. These are so similar, right? So similar. They have to add color to help you see that they're similar. And they're, that's supposed to be over there. So we have a flying, a swimming, a running, and a grasping arm. Sure, there is some common design, like here's a radius and ulna, and radius and ulna. That's kind of a radius and ulna, and yeah, they have some kind. Where's the phalanges there? I mean, they're kind of similar, but again, the keys to the Dodge, the Chrysler, and the Jeep are kind of similar too. That doesn't prove that they're evolving into each other. Creationists regard organisms as constructed on a common plan. Darwin explained homology on the basis of the theory of descent with slow and slight modifications. Now listen, the evolutionist explanation attributes homologous features to similar genes inherited from common ancestors. So they see homology and they go, that's because they were evolved. And then they turn around and say, homology means that they evolved. They have homology because they evolved, and they evolved because they had homology. Okay? The development of the digits proceed from posterior to anterior direction in frogs, but from head to tail in salamanders. So they even form in different parts. So they might look the same, but they're forming in completely different areas. In fact, the Neo-Darwin explanation of development genetics supposes that these structures in two different organisms are produced in similar genes, and that homologous structures are not produced by different genes, but that is not known that is now known not to be the case. It has been discovered that non-homologous structures commonly arise from identical genes. So non-homologous structures, things that are different, are coming from different genes. I mean, from the same genes. And then you have similar structures, homologous structures, that don't even come from common ancestry, like the octopus eye and the human eye, which are some of the two most complicated eyes out there. They don't come from common ancestry. So homology, you can look at it two different ways. It takes faith to believe in both, but Pontiac lug nuts will fit on a Chevy. And so Darwin's perplexity, I'm going to get into the human evolution, but then you have the human eye, the human ear, the human heart, the human skin, the human nervous system, the brain. I mean, this stuff, we're fearfully and wonderfully made. I mean, it's super complicated. It takes a lot of faith to think that I came from something that was like a monkey, that came from something that was like whatever that came from, that went all the way back down to a single cellular organism. It's a leap of faith. It's a leap of logic. You have to believe in it, and I don't. In fact, the eardrum movement is super tiny, and it tells us all these different sounds. It's not even the movement, it's not even a width of a hydrogen molecule, and they can tell me from my mom's voice to the tuba to every noise out there, and it's just a slight movement. Super complicated. Even Darwin looked at the eye and was staggered. We can't even duplicate what it can do. We can't even make, like we can kind of make the helicopter after the dragonfly and sonar after the whale, but we can't do what the eye can do. And I was going to go in the film, and we're not even close when it comes to cameras, doing what the eye can do. We can see clearly at different distances. The autofocus is just perfect. It is constantly vibrating, but it compensates for that. And then you can actually have studies where they have these glasses that flip the objects and make people wear them. After a few weeks, the brain readjusts, and it looks like you're seeing normal again. Amazing adaptation, amazing structure. And then you have the tonsils. There's these two small glands in the back of your throat, which just say you don't need anymore. Well, you need them. Trust me. It helps you from gastrointestinal problems with the appendix. And it basically keeps bad stuff that's coming in your mouth. Also, like the tonsils, the appendix fights infection. According to Science News, both tonsils and appendix are now believed to guard us against Hodgkin's disease. This is what, you know, if you believe in vested organs so much, when you, as an evolutionist, what they should do is when they have their little baby, they should have them removed to prove to us that they're not needed. And then maybe we can believe them, but they won't do that because they know that they're needed. Long regarded as vestal organs, with no function in the human body, the appendix is now thought to be one of the sites where immune response are initiated. There are no longer any justification to regard the vermiform appendix as a vestal structure. Boom. When was this? When I went to school, they told me that I didn't need that. And that wasn't in 1947. I'm not that old. The tailbone. The tailbone is where important muscles are attached. Very important. Very important. Like, that's very important. Bowel movement, very important. It didn't come from a tail from a monkey. You need that structure. And I don't know about you, I want to be able to walk and sit upright too. There's certain muscles that are attached to that. I was taught that you don't need that anymore. Well, if you believe that you don't need it anymore, you can have it removed, and you can prove me wrong. If you really, really trust in evolution. What about Job? You know, Job was this guy who had all this good stuff happening to him. All the good stuff. And then all this bad stuff happened to him. And he didn't know why. He started his friends would come over and say, God's punishing you. It's the hand of God. You know, you're a bad person. And all these objections. So Job could have doubted and said, if God's so good, why is the world so bad? And started doubting all this disaster and everything. He could have started doubting that, like Darwin did. That's one of the biggest reasons Darwin doubted was extinction and problems and death and all destruction. Job could have done that, but he trusted in God. And the Bible opens up this picture that the devil was doing it and that it wasn't God. And he could have gotten mad at all these hypocritical believers around him that said all these misconstrued things about God. And he could have believed all his friends, but he didn't. But they wore on him and wore on him, and he kind of slipped and he doubted. And then God came and started asking him all these questions. Mind you, this is the first book ever written. He's asking all these questions about life and about space and science. And I'm going to get into some of them in the future lecture. Just amazing questions that are just showing amazing technology back in the earliest written book of the Bible, the book of Job. And Job just realizes, I don't know anything. And it reminds me of a story. There's a speaker who's speaking over in the Eastern Bloc of Europe when the wall of communism fell. And then when it fell, he got invited to attend a university. And he didn't realize they set him up for a debate. And he doesn't like debating. I don't like debating. I took debate class. And I remember that when I took debate class, the valedictorian was in the debate class. I didn't know it at the time. He was going to be the valedictorian, but he was. And so I picked as my topic something I didn't believe in, because I knew I could argue something against what I believed in easier than I could something that I believed in, because I'd know all the objections and I knew how to rile people up. And I won and got an A, and he didn't. Then he went back and changed his grade, so that's how you get valedictorian. So, I debated, and I won the debate, and I didn't believe what I debated. The reason why I won the debate wasn't because I had the best evidence. It's because I riled them up and got them emotionally strong. So I don't believe in debate because it's not a good intellectual discipline. In fact, it was put in the Dark Ages by the people who wanted to control other people to make them look bad, and it was based on emotion and feeling and making people riled up. So I don't like debating. And neither did this guy. But he got suckered into it, and he said, well, fine, I'll speak first. And he was praying. He's just like, I just don't want to do this. And he's praying, and basically the guy had another appointment. So he said, all right, fine, this is what we'll do. Instead of me speaking an hour and him speaking an hour, I'll speak an hour and then open the floor to questions. And he spoke for an hour and he opened the floor to questions. And I'm nowhere near good enough to do that, but he's much older than I am. So he opened the floor to questions after he spoke. And the teachers were feeding the students questions, so it was totally set up. And so they got him and said, we went up in the space and saw all the stuff you saw, and we didn't see God. And he said, well, faculty, do you think your students know 50% of the information in the world? The faculty kind of looked at him, where is he going with this? Then he started naming things. Do you think your students know, like, all the dynasties of China? And then just one of those dynasties, can they name the kings in order? And do you think they can name all the sultans in order of, Turkey? And do you think they can... He started going with all these facts, science and history and archaeology, and they're just going, no. He's like, so what do you think? 45%. Kept going. He's like, 30. He's like, I think your kids are really smart. They probably know 5% of what you can know in the world. 5%. That's a lot, considering all the countries, all the history, all the science, all the disciplines, all the philosophy. If your students could know 5% of everything that could be known in the world, just 5%, don't you think that in the 95% of what they don't know, they could find something that proves the existence of God? Don't you think? Everybody was silent. It's logical, like you could. You can't possibly know everything. We can't even know 5%. The Bible says that if you seek me with all your heart, you shall find me. That's the key. The key is you have to do it with all of your heart. And that goes for Christian, non-Christian. Christians can doubt and just be playing a game and going through the motions, and sometimes they're the worst things for the world because they cause the others not to believe. Because when it comes down to it, the reason why I wasn't a Christian was not the facts. It's because I was hurt by Christians. I was hurt by hypocrites. I was hurt by people. And so when it comes down to it, I look at both sides of the issues. Creationism takes faith. Evolution takes faith. They're equal when you are unbiased. I've just been hurt by people so much. And when I put my trust in God, He's taken care of me so much. Now, mind you, I'm not talking about people who represent God who hurt me, because that would be in the people group. I just don't have enough faith in people, the trust, evolution, who came up with the theory. When I've searched God for all my heart, He has always delivered. Mind you, I'm not talking about people who misrepresent God. I'm talking about when I searched God with my whole heart, He fulfilled my faith. I hope that he'll do it to you, and I hope that you'll search for your whole heart, because that's the only way you could ever believe, is if you give 100% into it and look into it for a time. You can't do it just for a minute or a night, but really look into it. And don't let people who are in this group discourage your faith. Put it completely, utterly in God. Let's pray. God, we as people just mess each other up so bad. I mean, you can look at the Inquisition by people who said they believe in you, and then you can look at Stalin and Mao and Pol Pot, who said they believe in science and evolution, and Hitler. And Hitler's weird because he believed in both. And we can be jacked up and messed up by people. Help us to not let people get in our way of believing in you, no matter where we are. Because people just mess us up. Job was messed up by his friends. Help us to be honest with you and just be open-minded and not trusting that we know everything. I don't know everything, but I just want to know more. And so I just pray for everyone here that their faith would be increased. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.